feel the waves come crashing, come crashing down, down. Say, be still, my love. Open up your heart. Let the light shine in. Don't you understand?
Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable. Very nice to have you with us on this Wednesday. It's the 10th of April, and I hope you are all well. Just hearing the music of Colin Hay, who is playing the Troy Savings Bank Music Hall tonight. You can find out more information by going to troymusichall.org. Colin Hay, the frontman of, that's right, Men at Work.
Yes.
There you go.
Who could it be now, Joe?
Yes, that's right. He'll be playing songs from both the Men at Work catalog, as well as his solo catalog. And they've just got great stuff going on at Troy Savings Bank Music Hall. You should just check out their website and see all the wonderful offerings they have, including Colin Hay tonight. TroyMusicHall.org. Plus, you can see the playlist of what we'll be playing throughout the panel portion of the program by going to WAMC.org/roundtable.
Bring your Vegemite sandwich.
That's right, your Vegemite sandwich. I was weirdly singing that song at the top of my lungs about 2 days ago in the car, and I was like, I love that line. Good morning, all. Let me introduce our group, and we will get started. We have a lot to talk about, and we look forward to it. Let's begin with the preceptor in public speaking for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. No, science is at Harvard University. Terry Gibson. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
Very good. Yes, it's multiple sciences, not just one.
Yeah, it's not just one. Yeah, not, don't want to be myopic about it. No, multiple sciences, and you're working on all of them. Terry, it's a great pleasure. I thank you so much.
Of course I am. Thank you.
I just have to, let me just say this, because I want Terry to know this, but I want listeners to know this as well. When Terry lived here in the region and would come up and was a regular part of the show, and then one day he came up and he said, oh, I'm moving to Boston to teach at Harvard. And I thought, well, that's a great gig. And then I became very selfish, and I was worried that we would lose Terry as a panelist. And I just feel like we've won the lottery, because we, while it's unfortunate we don't get to see him, and I miss seeing him, it's just, we really appreciate you being on the show and adding your contributions to the program.
Well, thanks. I'm still a regular listener and supporter, and I miss you too, and I hope we can reunite sometime soon. I keep thinking about ways to get there. So I'm only like 2.5-3 hours away.
No, I know.
It's not like,
I know,
far.
It doesn't sound far when we talk about it like this, but when you actually have to get in the car and drive it, you're like, oh, we'll do it later.
But once we are in Boston,
yeah, thing called work.
Yeah,
called
right.
Work seems to get in the way too. Yeah.
But once we are in Boston, we can crash his preceptorship.
That's right. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Sure. You're welcome to my class anytime. You want to come be a guest speaker?
Associate,
come on in.
Associate preceptors for a day. That
yes.
Sounds fun.
Terry, I'll be in touch.
Please. I could use a break. Come on in.
I don't think I can promise this semester. I'm the same way as you. I'm like, anybody's welcome at this point to visit my class.
Siena yeah. College professor of comparative politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly, is a voice you hear right now, and wonderful to have you here as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm very happy to be here as well.
Thank you. And Bob Griffin is with us, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Bob, a great pleasure. We missed you last week.
Yeah,
it's good
thank
to have you.
You
back.
Yeah, thanks. I'm sorry. That pesky work thing got in the way.
No, I know.
Yeah.
No,
it's,
that does happen, doesn't it?
Just so all the panelists know that like that's a legitimate excuse.
Yeah.
We use that as, you know, you're volunteering your time. By God, you do your job that pays your money. Thank you all for being here. It's a great pleasure to have you on the program. That's where the listeners come in. You can be a part of this discussion by simply writing to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. If you're brand new to the program, this is how it works. We talk about a wide range of issues. We usually get to about four or five topics over the course of the next hour and 40 minutes or so. And then we welcome throughout this your thoughts. And you can write to us and tell us what you think about what we're talking about, whether you agree, whether you disagree, and what your take is on it. And we enjoy hearing that. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Yesterday, our big story was the fact that Donald Trump announced that he finally made his, and this is all going to be in air quotes, he made his policy on abortion known after sending mixed signals, a term used in the New York Times yesterday, after months of sending mixed signals, he made a video statement which basically was another mixed signal. So, but what it said was that it was going to be left up to the states and was trying to punt the issue and saying that because it is a very much a losing issue for the Republicans, it is certainly something that he wanted to address, and that was the way he chose to address it. Well, as if on cue, to make that seem like not a great decision, Arizona, the state of Arizona, has suddenly jumped to the center of the debate over abortion. Democrats seized on a ruling on Tuesday by Arizona's highest court upholding an 1864 law that bans nearly all abortions, setting up a fierce political fight over the issue that is likely to dominate the presidential election and a pivotal Senate race in a crucial battleground state. Even though the court put its ruling on hold for now, President Biden and his campaign moved quickly to blame former President Trump for the loss of abortion rights, noting that he has taken credit for appointing Supreme Court justices who overturned a constitutional right to abortion. Just a day earlier, Mr. Trump had sought to defang what has become a toxic issue for Republicans by saying that abortion restrictions should be decided by the states and their voters. Mr. Trump offered no immediate response to the decision, but Carolyn Leavitt, a spokeswoman for his campaign, said President Trump could not have been more clear. These are decisions for people of each state to make. Nowhere are the politics of abortion more distilled than in the state of Arizona, where liberal advocates have been pushing for a ballot measure in November that would enshrine abortion rights in the state constitution. Supporters of the measure say they have already gathered enough signatures to put the question on the ballot ahead of a deadline in early July. That means the state is likely to be front and center in a national push by Democrats to transform the 2024 race into another referendum on abortion rights. Terry Gibson, we'll start with you.
It would have been so much easier if voters would have come out in previous presidential elections to vote to support protecting rights to abortion. But that didn't happen, and we got people in office that wanted to do what so many in the Republican Party have been wanting to do for so long, which was to overturn Roe v. Wade. And here we are. And it's still, I think, just really hard for so many of us to believe that we have gone backwards so far. And this ruling in Arizona is just an awful reminder of how determined some segments of the society are to take us way, way, way back. And I sure hope that they get that referendum on the ballot. And I hate to think that this is what it's come to get voters out, but if it is, it is, and this is where we are. And it does seem that this is going to benefit the Democratic Party in terms of voter turnout across the country, certainly in Arizona. But I think it just also points to the real danger that the former Republican Party, now known as the MAGA Party, really presents to this country. They can't be trusted. Donald Trump can't be trusted. I don't think that women that are either considering having families or are just dealing with various reproductive health care issues, I don't think they're so concerned about what it is that politicians are saying. They're concerned about what is happening, what is the law now. And the fact that they have been deprived of, that the right to access legal reproductive health care across the country has been taken away from them, I think is what they're going to remember when they go to vote, regardless of what state they're in.
Vera.
I agree 100% with what Terry just said. If you are a young woman who is pursuing a family, thinking about having children, especially in the state of Arizona, you probably will delay, because if anything goes wrong at all and you need access to particular health care options and that is denied to you, your path is extremely complicated. And I feel really badly for young women in particular states where those rights are no longer enshrined, where they're considered people without decision-making capacity, without the ability. I mean, when you think about the law that was referred to from 1864, I mean, this is way before women were considered equal, had a right to vote, were thought of citizens in the same sense as men. And when we think about a state going back to those kinds of principles, it is truly shocking. And in that sense, we just need to move forward. And I agree, we have to get this, this ballot measure in front of the voters this fall. And hopefully people are energized and focused and get that situation resolved. And I find it amazing that we continue to have these discussions that access to basic health care is a state issue. It is not a state issue. It is a national issue. It should be an available right for people across the nation, the same way that we decide in other areas, we should decide that healthcare is accessible in the same way.
Bob.
Yeah, Vera, you pointed out 1864 was a rule that was put on the books when Arizona was still a territory. Arizona didn't even become a state until 1912. So you're talking about a rollback, to the time of the, almost the, the Wild West, if you will. Reading about this, it struck me as that the Supreme Court in Arizona, which is made across the board with conservative Republican governor appointments, found a way to ban abortion. That it was. I'll note that in the findings, in the briefs, it was noted that the court did not try to harmonize the 1864 law with the more recent law that was put in place, which is in itself, I thought, pretty draconian, which was a 15-week ban. Instead, they said, nope, 1864 was a good year to pick. And remember, there's no exception for rape or incest. There's also no exception to allow for medication assisted abortions. So we're right back into the whole issue of FDA approval and medication. Go ahead.
I'm still stuck on the fact that you try to be, as a governing body, look and say, well, what is the best way to represent the people of the state? I know. Let's go back to 1864.
And Joe, I think you just put your finger on my frustration with this, when we talk about the Supreme Court, it doesn't feel like what the best interests of the people are forefront in the minds of these appointees. you know, I've said before and I'll say again, and I'm sure I'll say again on this show, I think the Supreme Court is the most illegitimate body in government right now. That they are driven by their own partisan beliefs, and they warp the law in order to get to where they want to be. And if we talk about the January 6th case, if we talk about Trump's continued manipulation of the law, it really raises some incredibly important doubts as far as the whole justice for all. It also raises some doubts I'd like to toss on the table and hear from the other panelists too, is that there's been a movement in jurisprudence to the originalist movement, you know, going back to the intent of the founders. And I think this is a prime example of how dangerous this is, that this idea that the few white men who made the decisions back in the day, whether it was in 1864 or whether it was in the 1700s, somehow were gifted with all of the knowledge that we would ever need, and that our society doesn't advance or change, and therefore the law shouldn't advance or change. I'll also note, in sort of a perverse way, I'm actually really glad that this came down when it did, because one, it shows how empty Trump is in his policy positions. Just like his position on infrastructure, just like his position on replacing Obamacare or what he wants to do with health care, it's always, oh, I'm going to make a big announcement. And then his big announcement is, I have no idea what I'm going to do, so I'm not going to make an announcement. We're going to make it state rights. After he's been on, you know, crowing about how he is personally responsible for the end of Roe v. Wade. As far as the election, I want to go back and have more conversations on this, because I think abortion and the issue of abortion and the issue of loss of rights, the alienation of women in our society, will bring people to the ballot box. I think Biden needs to be very careful, though. That doesn't mean they're going to pull the lever for him. That doesn't mean that they're going to vote for him. But they will be. The people will show up because of this issue. But to say it's the only issue is the wrong way to approach it.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll dive in, much more to discuss on this issue. We welcome your thoughts as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will be right back.
Much as I try, I can't stop thinking about you.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. So nice to have you with us. We appreciate your time and your interest in being a part of these conversations about the news of the day. Panel at WAMC.org if you would like to join us. Panel at WAMC.org. I wonder, you know, this also comes in the exact moment where 2 weeks after the Florida and the 6-week abortion mm-hmm. ban. So these are both issues that have very much come to the forefront of our sort of knowledge, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. We're going to come back to this subject, and we'll talk more, and we certainly welcome your letters. I'm going to take a bit of a detour for just a moment, because we have a wonderful, one of our wonderful panelists has come in and is going to talk about an issue that is on our docket and unfortunately it has been a part of a national and international news story, and I wanted to talk about it as a whole and obviously get her thoughts on this. Sarah Rogerson is with us from the Albany Law School and the Immigration Law Clinic. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well.
Good. So yesterday was the sentencing in Michigan. The parents of Ethan Crumbly were sentenced to prison, And this is after a school shooting case in Michigan in which your nephew was shot in that horrific event.
In the face with a Sig Sauer semi-automatic weapon that his father purchased for him for Christmas.
So you've been watching this, and I'm curious as to, I mean, it was 10 to 15 years for both parents, right?
Right.
What does that mean to you and to your family?
Well, it's different for different members of the family. Not all of us are feeling the same way, and that's to be expected, but we're all talking about it, which is important. And, you know, listening to other victims' families and survivors' families, 4 kids died. Their families feel differently about it. I think what is a unifying factor in all of the reactions is that the law is incomplete and does not afford, you know, real justice for anybody, including the Crumbly family. I personally watched Ethan's trial, and I felt a lot of anger that there weren't systems sitting next to him. You know, what about the systems that failed him in childhood? What about the school district that failed to provide him with appropriate supports, or certainly the parents, right? Like that was pretty obvious from the very beginning of what happened here. So as this has played out over the last 2+ years, you know, we're self-educating, we're learning about community gun violence as a whole. Mass school shootings are actually a very small percentage of community gun violence that happens every day for kids all over the country. We're learning about the role of firearms in suicide, not just for kids. It's the leading cause of death. Firearms-related incidents are the leading cause of death now for children in the United States. But also for veterans and first responders, the access to a weapon makes suicide astronomically more likely. So where we've come down on this is, this is a story about safe storage. If there's anything to take away from what's happening here, it's if you are a gun-owning parent or not a gun-owning parent, you should be talking to other parents about their firearms, whether they own them, where they're keeping them. We can have these conversations in order, as adults, in order to keep the kids safe. So to the extent that the verdicts send that message, that is helpful. And there is a measure of accountability. I had a lot more sympathy for James and Jennifer Crumbly until they started talking, because on the stand, Jennifer Crumbly said she wouldn't have changed anything or done anything differently. And then yesterday she tried to clarify that, and it didn't. Her clarification was more diffusion of responsibility. Yep. So it's time for parents to step up.
She said yesterday, "I stand today not to ask for your forgiveness, as I know it may be beyond reach, but to express my sincerest apologies for the pain that has been caused." But
not the pain I caused.
No, exactly. Right. She doesn't take any responsibility for her part. I mean, it's shocking. That's a non-apology and a non-admission. I mean, so almost like she tried to sound legalese in that way.
And the lawyer for Mr. Crumbly basically said that he served 2 years in jail while awaiting trial and should be let go for time served. I mean, I understand you do that for your client, but as far as what's right.
Yeah, one of the victim's parents, I think it was Hannah's, said, "I'm serving a life sentence without my child."
Yeah.
And that's that, right?
So this, just to give it a little clarification, November 30th, 2021 was the shooting. 11 people were injured in that shooting. 4 students died, were killed. Several others seriously injured. The 15-year-old student was later arrested in connection with the shooting Ethan Crumbly, as Sarah mentioned. The idea of what is a just punishment in something like this is hard to get your wrap your brain around, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I had a difficult moment. My sister and I were on national news media outlets all day yesterday, and that we could have probably a separate conversation about in terms of how these things are covered.
I definitely want to have that conversation.
I really appreciate being here. I feel a lot more comfortable here. But, you know, there was oh, now I lost my train of thought, which is bound to happen.
Yes. You were talking about you and your sister were having a conversation last night.
Yeah, I know, but there were so many.
Yeah.
What was your question? I just lost it.
No, we were just talking about how you wrap your brain around what is a just punishment.
Yeah. Right. So on one of the news segments, they mentioned that after the sentencing, the attorneys for James and Jennifer had made requests of some sort to see if the family could be housed together. And the rules of the prison system don't allow for that. And I just had a moment of, I don't know, mental incongruence there because, right, that's family separation too. How do we expect the Crumblies to do differently, to learn differently, to heal differently, to move differently together? How do we expect a kid who was tried as an adult, who is serving life without parole, how do we expect that? That doesn't make me feel better.
No.
That doesn't do anything for Elijah, my nephew. And he would say that too. We've run everything that we say publicly by Elijah because he is a teenager and he is entitled to his own privacy and his own opinions on the matter. So I'm not speaking for him, but I do know that he has similar complicated feelings about Ethan, the shooter.
Did he know him?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, had class with him.
Yeah, but not.
Right before it happened. But right. Yeah, they weren't friends.
How old is he now? You're
Elijah, 16. I'm like thinking, yeah. 78 million years old, actually.
I'm sure he's aged quite a bit over the last 2 years. So what, in the nature of his injuries that as of now?
My sister reminded me yesterday he's getting new teeth. So the bullet grazed two of his fingers because he put his hand up. And then went in his mouth, through his teeth, and then out his cheek. So he was extremely lucky. He lives with a lot of survivor's guilt. It could have been very, very different for him.
So, I mean, one of the things that was fascinating about this case, and of course you being a lawyer and a professor at a prestigious law school, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, I would think it's impossible to remove yourself from that. But this was sort of a reckoning of what parental responsibility looks like. We haven't really grappled with this too much yet, as to what the responsibilities are for the parents.
Yeah. Well, and in a very narrow set of circumstances, right? So the prosecutor was very clear that this isn't, you know, like, oh, this isn't setting a precedent that is going to, we hope, scoop up people outside of this specific circumstance of buying your child a gun illegally. By the way, it was a straw sale. Ethan Crumbly is not an eligible firearm purchaser.
Correct. Yeah,
as a
exactly.
child.
Yeah.
So even, you know, so and from a licensed firearms dealer, there's a lawsuit pending against the firearms dealer as well. My family is also a part of that. They have not been held accountable at all. They're still operating. We drive by their gun shop, Acme Guns and Ammo, every time I visit. Yeah, I always think of the Roadrunner.
Well, yeah.
That's what my trauma brain does.
Exactly. That's like, exactly what it would be.
Meep, meep. So, Yeah, there's so there are multiple pieces of the accountability puzzle that are still coming together. Mm-hmm. But certainly when a parent purchases a firearm illegally for a child who is ineligible, then the mother takes the child to a shooting range. Then the kid starts drawing disturbing images of shooting other people, says he's hearing voices, tells his parents, the school district brings the parents in. Like, at what point do we say, okay, that's enough? Okay, that's enough. Now, there should be threat assessment teams. There should be a lot of other things happening. But for parental responsibility, what, like the judge was saying, it was a runaway train. There were so many signs. And the parents completely rejected Ethan's cries for help.
It also, I mean, we've talked about this a lot. We've been talking about it a lot as these shootings continue to take over our thoughts, and they happen way too frequently. But I'm curious as to the culture of it, where at any point you think it's a good thing to give a minor a powerful weapon of war. I mean, regardless of the mental anguish the child was going through, that they may or may not have been aware of where that comes in, where you say this is a good idea.
Well, and to go back to secure storage, they claimed that they stored the gun securely, but the gun storage unit that they used was set to its manufacturer default setting, which was 0000. So that wasn't going to deter the child from having access. I'm all about parents and responsible gun owners teaching their kids how to responsibly handle firearms. I myself, before this happened, took a firearms safety class sponsored by the NRA, because they're the only ones that sponsor them. I'm working on changing that too, because you shouldn't have to pay the NRA to learn about guns if that's something that you're curious about. And I figured if I'm going to be responsible in talking about this issue, I should at least know what I'm talking about. And at the time, the SAFE Act didn't allow you to handle a firearm before you had a permit, which was ridiculous, because that meant I went to this class at some rod and gun club, I think in Clifton Park. I took a couple of classes. I got the certificate. I took the test. I never touched a gun, and I could have applied for a permit, purchased one, and used it. So they've changed that. There's now like a field test component, which makes a whole lot more sense. And I really don't have a problem with even little kids learning about how to use guns safely. What I do have a problem with is unrestricted access to firearms and irresponsible gun ownership. And this idea that if we just put them on a top shelf, the kids aren't going to find them. Because that's, if anyone who's ever tried to hide anything from a kid knows that that's just not how this works.
Sarah Rogerson is here, a panelist, regular panelist on this program, a law professor at Albany Law School, and as well as the aunt of a child who was gravely injured in the shooting in Michigan. Jennifer and James Crumbly, who were convicted of involuntary manslaughter for failing to prevent their teenage son from killing four fellow students in the deadliest school shooting in Michigan's history, were each sentenced on Tuesday to 10 to 15 years in prison. Their separate jury trials ended in guilty verdicts in February and March, making them the first parents in the country to be convicted over the deaths caused by their child in a mass shooting. A moment ago, Sarah, you said as far as the NRA having these gun safety courses, and you said that's one of the other things I'm trying to change. What is your agenda look like? And I use that word positively of what
yeah.
you know, you would like to see come out of this horrific crime?
Well, and one thing I've neglected to say is that communities of color experience community gun violence at disproportionately high rates, right? So we're a white family. This is a white rural suburb, very, very far suburb of Detroit or Flint, depending on how you look at mm-hmm. it. And, you know, when the white kids' schools get shot by typically other white kids, it becomes pretty sensational. And this is an everyday issue. So another complicating factor is that although I'm happy that these parents were held accountable, we know that the criminal justice system also disproportionately targets historically minoritized communities. And what I don't want to see happen is a lot of black and brown families disproportionately held to account on very different facts and very different circumstances. I don't think that's going to happen, but that's been niggling in the back of my mind as these trials of the parents have gone forward. And so I don't think I have an agenda in as much as I want to self-educate, redirect to responsible resources. We have the Regional Gun Violence Consortium right here in our backyard at the Rockefeller Institute. It's people from as far south as Virginia and all the way up to Maine, I think. Scholars, interdisciplinary scholars, regularly pumping out reports that are evidence-based and scientific about what works and what doesn't work. So things like school lockdown drills, if done in a trauma-informed way, actually do help mitigate the harm caused, right? I don't like that fact. I don't like that my kids are having to engage in lockdown drills. But if it keeps them alive until we fix the other problems, fine. Threat assessment teams are a critical component of this, and they're understudied. Gun violence research generally is underfunded. So how are we going to solve a problem when we don't invest in the people who are trying to figure out how to stop it?
We've talked about that a lot, right? That we don't put that money available and we don't know enough. We don't study it. We don't look at it, which seems unbelievable to me.
I was prohibited when I was running the science and technology director for DHS. I was prohibited by Congress from actually doing any research into safe, you know, smart gun technologies, safe gun technologies. So it's actually prohibited by Congress, which again I think gets back to Sarah's point about the power of the NRA has had in sort of pulling the strings on basic issues of safety.
Yep.
And an organization that's like falling apart.
Falling apart.
Scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think gun safety should be accessible to everyone.
Right.
If you are a leftist, you should know how to, you know, you should, and you want to learn more about firearm safety, you should have a way to do that.
The judge, Cheryl Matthews, of the Oakland County Circuit Court in Pontiac, Michigan, said before issuing the sentence, "Parents are not expected to be psychic, but these convictions are not about poor parenting. These convictions confirm repeated acts or a lack of acts that could have halted an oncoming runaway train, repeatedly ignoring things that would make a reasonable person feel the hair on the back of her neck stand up." Do, being a lawyer and looking at this, and obviously you're very much, you know, you're biased by the love of your family and of your nephew.
Yep.
How do you feel the trial went and the judge's performance?
I thought that Karen McDonald, the Oakland County prosecutor, is fantastic. And I forget his first name, but Keist, her number two, who tried this case. They both were impeccable. Like I have been tempted, if I weren't so triggered by it, to show clips of these various trials in classes, just because it's a masterclass in what to do and what not to do. Mm-hmm. The defense team was underperformed. I don't think that they were incompetent by any means, but they from a presentation standpoint, could have made a lot of different choices. I don't think it would have changed the outcome. And that's what the judge was saying yesterday. So the defense was trying to say, but what about this? And what about this? And, what, you know, in the Miller hearing, in which certain evidence was excluded, blah, 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 you know, this would have made a difference. And the judge was very clear. I don't think that would have changed the outcome. Or how does that go to the elements of the crime? You know, they're not on trial for being bad people. Or, you know, for being even bad parents, they're on trial for gross negligence. So
right. That's
there are elements to that crime, and the prosecution has proven those elements, and two juries found them guilty. So, you know, it's not. I think the judge was resolute. I think she was professional. I think everybody involved was professional. And it was the first of its kind lawsuit, so everybody was under intense scrutiny, and I think that the judge, as far as judges who end up in cases where a lot of people are watching and it's on court TV and what have you, go, the fact that not a lot has been said about her probably speaks the most to how she ruled over the case.
We talked about this for a moment earlier on when you came on about this serving as a playbook. Is this a good playbook for the moment?
In terms of parental responsibility, I think in cases, again, where parents purchase a weapon, a deadly weapon for their child, failed to secure it, teach them how to use it, and ignore warning signs of predictive, dangerous behavior to themselves or others, certainly.
Don't you think it would have been enough to just for the parents to purchase a weapon of war for an underaged young child? I mean, this is not something that is legally permitted. So that alone we should look at, right?
I mean,
that is an adult's responsibility. Parent, relative, neighbor, friend. If you're an adult and you use your name to purchase a weapon of war for somebody who's underaged and then uses it, I think that sends a pretty strong message now.
Yeah. I mean, and I want to be clear, the weapon used in this case, it's a Sig Sauer. It's used by a lot of police officers. So it wasn't like an automatic rifle with bump stock, multiple, you know, magazines. I've learned a lot about guns. Not enough. I still mess things up. But, you know, this particular weapon is pretty common, which is maybe even like scarier in a way, because, you know, and really why my small A agenda is we're not going to get rid of them.
Right.
Not in this country. We have millions and even if there was a ban tomorrow, we would have so many weapons that we all need to know, recognize risks. It's an all of community approach. We all need, and there are opportunities to, no matter what you do for a living or for a calling, no matter what your role is in society, you can do at least one or two things to get at this issue. Even if it's just talking to your neighbors or the homes where your kids sleep over and say, hey, do you guys have guns? If so, where do you store them? It doesn't need to be this like atomic bomb politically as parents to talk about, you know, do you have guns in the home and where do you, you know, are they secure?
We just have a minute or two before we go to a break, and Sarah has to leave us. But Terry, is there anything you wanted to add to the discussion or any question you had?
Well, I was not aware that Sarah had family members that were involved in this. I found that very surprising and shocking, and I can only imagine what your family has gone through. And I certainly appreciate her perspective. I do think ultimately what we need is a federal government that takes responsibility for keeping us safe. And I think while I am grateful that these parents have been held accountable, until we hold our elected officials accountable to providing legislation that protects us, then we're always going to, I think, continue to have this problem.
And fix the funding issues. Congress could do that tomorrow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the other thing, too, that made this case is right after it happened or in the hours and days after, that there was just this, the storyline was these parents were so proud to give the child the gun, and which I guess was supposed to be a Christmas present, and they gave it to them early, and it was, and then everybody was bragging about how they had I mean, that whole part of the culture was deeply disturbing.
Yeah, there's a deep gun culture in America.
Yeah.
And not just in these types of neighborhoods and communities.
I thank you so much for being with us. I know you're doing the rounds here, and I can't imagine you know, living through that horror and then having to relive it and talk about it. But I think it's very beneficial that we hear from those who are impacted, and I so appreciate you and your family and the beautiful work that you've done throughout this, and wish you nothing but healing as the days and weeks go forward.
Thanks so much, Joe.
Sarah Rogerson with us. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation on other issues, and we will welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back.
Love is blind, and you soon will find you're just a boy again.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have Vera Carias-Kelly, Terry Gibson, and Bob Griffin with us this morning. Talked a moment ago to Sarah Rogerson about the sentencing of the parents of a school shooter in the suburbs of Detroit, Michigan, which was very powerful. And I thank Sarah so much for coming in and talking to us about it. We have a couple of letters on this. Mm-hmm. And then we'll move kind of back a little bit to the abortion. And then because we started the program off talking about the abortion ruling in Arizona, we have some thoughts on that. And then we'll move on to other topics. So here we go. Rose writes, as a parent of an autistic son with mental illness, I'm concerned with the consequences of holding parents for a child's behavior. My son was going through a period of having violent rages and threatened to do harm to me, my other son, and others. I called agencies and the police many times, and they told me they couldn't help until he actually commits a crime. However, to be clear, we would never buy him a gun. These parents were an accessory to a crime, period. Mm-hmm. I worry that this ruling may hold any parent responsible, even the ones who have tried to blow the whistle. That seems like a very reasonable concern.
It is, but my read of it, though, is that even the judge was saying, and we certainly heard it from Sarah, that this was a defined, very narrow set of events. It was the illegal action of purchasing a handgun for a minor, which was illegal, which led to the charges. I understand the letter writer's concern, but I agree with one of the things Sarah said, is I don't see this as setting a new precedent. Would get us into that whole issue of sins of thy father and mother type issues.
I agree. I think this particular case was about gross negligence by the parents and not about how we judge parenting skills or how we judge families that are struggling with particular cases of mental health and don't get the assistance from the state or from our state agencies. I mean, I think that is an entirely different conversation. I think this particular case was about parents who enthusiastically supported the purchase of a gun that was illegal to be accessed by a minor.
Knowingly illegal.
Knowingly illegal, yes.
Terry?
Yeah, I mean, I think the real issue here is that parents put a lethal weapon in the hands of one of their children. And without proper supervision, proper education, there is no good outcome of that. And we desperately need more laws on the books at the federal level that make the ability of parents to do this, make it really difficult. And right now it is not difficult. In fact, it's incredibly easy to purchase a gun and put it in the hands of anybody that you want.
Let's see. I have a couple more letters I'm going to get to. Charles writes, as someone whose family has been directly involved with tragic gun violence, the issue at its essence for me is this. With a gun, my sister-in-law is dead. Without a gun, she would be alive. And as gun rights and Second Amendment advocates suck all the air out of the room arguing about their rights, my sister-in-law will still be dead. Guns should be banned, full stop, end of story. And there will be people, of course, who disagree with that, but you can certainly understand Charles's point and why he feels that way.
And Joe, we've said it before on the show, at what point in time did the Second Amendment become the ultimate right versus the rest of our right to our pursuit of life, safety, and just basic living? It's out of whack. And as you look at the NRA and the NRA's case, you see sort of the corruption of our society through money and gifts and high living. And again, I look at it and I think, you know, I equate it to what I see with Alito and Justice Thomas taking trips from people who are have cases in the court before them, and it really is showing a rot in our system that needs to be addressed.
And in my view, gun manufacturers get away with murder, because under what democratic structural conditions can you just simply produce weapons of war and disseminate them fairly freely to the population? As a matter of fact, our gun manufacturing supports the weaponization along the southern border, and the cartels are armed because of our gun manufacturing and sales going across the border. We have many issues to address, and this is, I think, a beginning of having a different kind of conversations about who to be held responsible for the dissemination of these weapons of war.
I think part of that conversation, too, and it's a wonderful point, I think part of the conversation is becoming more vital, because the degrees of separation are becoming so close now. I mean, I know someone very well and who is a friend who was directly impacted by this. Mm-hmm. And as our last letter writer, I mean, it is affecting more and more and more of us. Mm-hmm. And I think as that tragically continues, the conversation is going to change, because we know the firsthand effects. It's not abstract. It's something that you very much feel.
But can we go back to something Sarah said that I think is really important? Gun violence is occurring at a higher rate in our Black and Brown communities, and the trauma that it's causing in those communities is something that we are not addressing. And I think that there's that is an underlying issue, Joe, that we don't spend a lot of time talking about. After dealing with the shooting and the response and the review, you still have trauma in a community that never goes away. And we have some communities even in and around Albany and in the capital region here in New York that suffer through that threat every single day. And as a society, we're not addressing these issues.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to say, for the first time in my life, Joe, you mentioned the experience of having, you know, people in your circle or you interact with people that suddenly have gone experienced, or you have different levels of conversations because people have experienced gun violence. For the first time in my life, I was involved in an interviewing process where a candidate asked, well, how safe is this campus? What kind of training is available? What kind of, support is there? Because I have experienced a shooting. I mean, I was stunned to have that as part of an interviewing question. but it shows the reality of life in the United States.
Well, and I was just reading about this last night, but you know that young kids, preschool, kindergarten, first grade, are telling you about what they're being taught.
Yes.
And you think, oh my God, why is a child being put through that? And well, it's the reality of our world that makes that.
But you know,
necessary.
Can I bring this back to the Arizona situation in this whole definition of what right to life really means? You know what we talk about abortion and abortion laws it's really we're talking about forced birth, right? Because the issue of what's our right to life, the idea that our in my mind. Our children should be able to walk home from school without the fear of abduction or violence or being shot. That that you should be able to walk down Central Ave without the fear of being attacked. I mean, it's time as a society we have a much broader conversation about what right to life really means.
And some of the. You know, the hardcore abortion access, people that want to control everything around it. It's not about necessarily right to life. It's about, it's a control issue, controlling women's bodies, controlling women's decision-making abilities. They don't have the same kind of conversations when it comes to, you know, executions of convicted murderers. They don't have the same conversations about children once they are born and live in society and don't get the necessary societal support. What kind of life do they live, and how as a society are responsible? Are we, you know, jointly responsible for the lives that people have? That is not the conversation about life we are having, right? And so I agree with you. This is very one-sided, limited, and we need to broaden our approach to having conversations about what life in the United States really should mean.
I want to go to
You know, Joe.
Yes, please, Terry. No, I was going to come to you. Yes, go ahead.
I was just going to follow up on about this whole concept of life and how there's so many different perspectives around it, depending on your political affiliation and how you feel about the Second Amendment. But I think Bob's mention of being able to walk down Central Avenue and not worry about being shot. There's portions where it's realistic to have some worry about that. And those who are staunch supporters of the Second Amendment, were really loyal supporters of the NRA back during its heyday, will argue that their right to life is when walking down Central Avenue, their right to life is to be able to carry a firearm so they can protect themselves, because there is a reason to worry about that. And I think Sarah mentioned this point too when she was on, and that in many ways the NRA really got what they wanted, because there is now such a proliferation of firearms. There are now just so many firearms in the market. They're available, both legal and illegally, that the idea of really taking them away is really difficult now, because they're already there. And in many ways that has helped those who want to make the argument that we have a right to protect ourselves. There are so many firearms out there. Everybody can access one. Well, I should be able to have one too, so I can protect myself against those that have them. And it's this vicious circle that we've created that we can't get out of. And it makes it really challenging. You hear this argument all the time about, since there are illegal guns out there, then I should be able to have a gun to protect myself.
One more letter on the gun issue in Michigan from Ken, and then I want to move to the letters on the abortion decision coming out of the state of Arizona. Ken writes, in this horrific case, the parents' responsibility issue presently is receiving most of the attention. However, what are the mental health issues at play? Why do the parents get a seemingly short sentence when their son, who everyone agrees was mentally ill and needed help, get life imprisonment without parole? I realize that he committed this horrible crime, but if he is truly mentally ill, shouldn't that have been considered in his punishment? and is his punishment deserved? Were there other possibilities, and what of others, school officials, for example, who dropped the ball on this? Just wondering. And I mean, I was struck by Sarah's empathy as to the child and how we treat these very troubled young people.
There's just some real inconsistencies that we have as a society that we're just not getting our arms around. And the question, I think, here, the fundamental question of is it just punishment, or is it, you know, what are we doing to try to address the underlying mental health issues, and is locking this child up for the rest of his life, is that doing what's right for him and doing what's right for society? And again, that's what justice is supposed to be about, right? What's best for the overall society. The letter writer, I think, gets to just a huge issue with where we are right now in our society, and this is this overall not understanding or having a clear position on mental health and its impact. I mean, during break we were talking about sort of struggles that some of us are having in classrooms with our students and the pressure that are under in their mental health, and we're not really addressing it. And I don't know, Vera, if
no,
you,
I mean,
or Terry want to jump in on it.
But we're not trained as mental health professionals, right? We can refer, we can encourage, but in essence, parents or in our case, adult students need to take the next step. We can't just simply report somebody without having professional knowledge and saying, well, they're, I mean, if we have clear signs of that, but that's rarely the case.
Yeah, and
that we have
some,
clear signs.
I wasn't so
challenges.
Much talking about your responsibility. It was more the issue that whether the safety net even exists in some situations.
Well, that's why
or
Sarah
how robust it is. Yeah.
Was saying, the young man as a murderer is on trial, mm-hmm. but what about the systems that should have been on trial along with him, that failed throughout. And I think she's right. We're not properly addressing, how we don't really know how to intervene in all these circumstances unless we have many participants in the structure and we all collaborate and we all have a flow of information that helps us find a common approach. But neither school systems nor parents or family structures nor police nor healthcare nor any of these kinds of structures really have figured out a shared approach to how to identify potential challenges that need to have an intervention. We rarely succeed.
I know this isn't a popular opinion, but those kids who are pulling the triggers are very much victims as well. And how does a 14-year-old child in that very short 14-year span build up the anger and the frustration and the consternation that has them move to violence against people that are directly around them? And I mean, to your point, Vera, I mean, how and what, and this was from an earlier letter about parental responsibility. What are our systems? We had that letter that said, I've called the police. I've called different social service agencies, and they say, well, they can't do anything until there's a crime. Well, we're trying to avoid a crime.
Right.
We're trying to work on that, and it's very difficult. And I know that certainly those in the camp of gun rights and are very quick to make these shooters out to be the devil. And I think we often forget that they're children.
The combination.
Well, Jill,
go ahead,
Terry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to just also point out the way that children are educated in school now, you know, in K through 12. At some point, most schools do provide courses that teach young people about the dangers of alcohol, about the dangers of drugs, maybe even about the dangers of driving. But do they have courses that teach you about the dangers of owning a lethal firearm? No, what we do instead is we teach them how to hide in their classroom when their school is attacked by a mass shooter. That's what we teach them. And it's to me, it's just amazing that we are not taking serious efforts to really train young people about the danger of the society we live in and what they can do as members of society to begin to change that dynamic rather than just hiding from it. And if there happens to be someone in the school that is suffering psychologically somehow, for whatever reason, and they are constantly being shown that, hey, to make my classmates really scared, I see what they're going to have to do if I decide, you know, to bring a gun to campus one day.
Terry,
because
I have
they're
to,
going through these active drills.
I have to pause you there just because we have to take a break, but we'll pick it up on the other side. We'll be right back after the short break.
I like drinking Irish tea with a little bit of lapsang souchong. I like making my own tea.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable, and welcome to our discussion, very weighty discussion this morning. And I appreciate everyone's thoughtful comments and thoughts on these very hard issues. I promised that I would go to the many emails that we received earlier in the program regarding the abortion decision made yesterday in Arizona, and jumping to the center of Arizona's 2024 election season. We got this from Carolyn: disregarding the issue of right to bodily autonomy, which one can't. What was the state of maternal health care in 1864 Arizona? What was the maternal death rate? What was the state of medical imaging? As I understand it, the state of medical treatment was amputation. That's when that law was written.
Excellent.
Yep.
Excellent point.
I agree.
And again, I think it goes back to the earlier point that, you know, this is the danger of the originalist movement, that the law isn't supposed to progress and change and evolve the way society has. Instead, it's rooted in those times, which again, Joe, I would also argue was rife with you know, misogyny and racism, and that we have glorified the old West, but you know, when you really get into it you know, not one of us would want to live that way. But now we're being forced to follow the laws from then.
I'm going to continue with these letters. Please, panelists, jump in if you have anything you want to say. Terry, when you take your phone off mute, I can hear that. So that's my sign that you want to talk. So just do that, and I will and I will come
I'm
to
sorry.
You. No,
what
don't be sorry. No, I said when you take your phone off mute, I can hear that. So that's a nice sign for me that you want to talk.
Oh.
So
should I mute myself now?
No. Well, whenever, yeah. I never want you to be muted. I always want to hear what you have to say. I'm just, as I read through the letters, just pop in and please just join in. Christopher writes, while it is incredible that women should be governed by a 19th century law, should we take a breath and work through the process? The ruling has been stayed for 14 days. Signatures to put the issue on the ballot have been collected. There will be an election this fall. I'm not saying we should leave this to chance, but if we want a result protecting women's rights to be enshrined and survive challenge, shouldn't we follow the process?
Yeah, I mean, in my view, this is all sounds very reasoned. However, I think we have a lot of judges and a lot of legislators practicing medicine without a license, because they make decisions that are simply between a patient and a physician. And these people are specifically trained to give you the advice based on our current technology and the information we have about how a woman should be treated with particular conditions or people in general. And all this conversation about this politicizing, about how women should or should not have certain access to medical treatment, is simply appalling, because these people make decisions about what I as a woman or I as a patient should be discussing exclusively with physicians.
It's also, while the letter writer, I understand the, you know, what the letter writer said, I'll also note, though, that this has to be an alarm bell, okay? And the alarm needs to go out now, because you just can't start to educate and to mobilize a week before the election. So now is the time to begin to mobilize. I will also note the trend that I've seen, like in places like Ohio, where we have had Republican members of Congress and other politicians in the state actually advocate for ignoring the referendum. So you start to see where there's a lot of pressures on this. It was stayed. However, the court was very clear that the ultimate law on reproductive rights is based off of the 1864 law in Arizona. And if people in Arizona don't get involved now, then they're going to lose an awful lot more than they've had.
And the idea to punish physicians for giving the most technologically informed scientific advice and recommendations to patients is also something that sounds rather medieval. And if you don't watch out, that is our future, because there are always people who will say, oh, but the election was stolen, and oh, but you know, this referendum was manipulated. It may not be, you know, authentically representing the voice of the people. I mean, this is the entire agenda out there to sort of bulldoze all of us and our rights.
This letter is from Kit. I felt compelled to respond to Terry's response to the abortion topic, which I largely agree with. But his first comment about it being, quote, a shame that voters did not turn out to vote for politicians to protect abortion rights hit a nerve. I am continuously outraged that the Republicans whittle away my reproductive rights. But I'm also outraged that the Democrats don't take responsibility for not further protecting abortion when they had the chance. Terry?
Yeah, absolutely. Hear, hear. I totally agree with that comment. We had multiple opportunities to do this, and we didn't do it. And I hope that we get another chance and hope we do it then. And I hope that Democratic voters realize the stakes that are before us in this election on many issues, and abortion obviously being one of them. They've got to turn out to support this. If we cannot get more people elected at all levels of government that want to protect a woman's rights to reproductive health care, then we're not going to get it at a federal level, because there are just too many powerful forces fighting against it. And the Democratic Party has tried in the past very hard to make this a voter issue, but for whatever reason, it has not always been able to bring out as many voters as it should have, and we're paying the price for that. And I was involved in elections where I witnessed that. It was just unable to move voters for this. Even in Hillary Clinton's election, we tried to use this to move voters, and it just wasn't successful as it should have been. But it's the past is the past. Now we've got to focus on the future, and the future looks pretty dark when we start reverting back to laws that were in place when Abraham Lincoln was in office.
Well, and if you think about it, Joe, I mean, this was considered settled law. I mean, if you think about the confirmation hearings on everyone on the Supreme Court, right, the pat response was always the smug little smile going, oh, this is settled law. I don't need to give you an answer on where I stand on this. So there was a belief that this was settled, that this was interwoven into the fabric of who we are. And boy, we proved to be gullible and naive in that. And what we need to be really careful of is that there are other settled laws, things like access to contraceptives, to interracial marriage, to these elements that you know we kind of assumed now we own as a natural right as a citizen of this country, that these forces of evil are working against, and frankly they're working against every day, and they have big deep pockets.
John Wright
and Joe, I think
go ahead, Terry.
I just want to make one other point about voting. I think it just gets lost too often. And certainly for Democrats, we must remember this, that the majority of judges in this country are appointed by elected officials. They're not elected. They're appointed. So when we are voting for people to represent us at all levels of government, state and federal and local, we are electing people that are going to have a lot of say-so who oversees the justice system. And we know by many previous rulings that many of the people that have been appointed to serve as judges at various levels of courts of the country, they don't use the law to interpret their decisions. They use their religious beliefs. They use their political beliefs. They don't even really need to be able to read the law, apparently. And that's because MAGA-leaning people have been elected, and they have chosen MAGA-leaning justices to represent them. And that's why these courts are coming up with these insane rulings that really work against modern-day society.
A few more letters I want to get to before we wrap up on this Wednesday morning. John writes, about 20 years ago, someone said something that has stuck with me. The Republican Party is trying to repeal the entire 20th century. And everything the Republican Party now embraces is 19th century, from systemically entrenched white supremacy to stripping women of personhood to exterminating LGBTQ plus people like me, which is why I expect the Republican Party's armed wing to execute me sometime in the 2030s. Yes, it's coming. Don't kid yourself that it's not. Barbara says, I don't understand, but without having read the actual laws and only hearing reports in the media, I only hear the consequences of jail time for doctors and pregnant women. What about the father? If abortion has been deemed illegal by the Supreme Court, doesn't that make it federal law? The father is a very interesting part of this equation as well. Mike says, easier said than done in regards to abortion rights, but we need some brave doctors in Arizona to get arrested to show the rest of the nation what Trump did. I believe it would help sway independents to Biden and tip the election for him.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's always, you will always find a few people who are willing to do that, but it is a big sacrifice to be arrested and then deal with the, you know, with the consequences and fallout and job loss and potential, you know, impact on your family. So this is not an easy ask. But I suspect, as always, we will find a few people who are courageous enough to test the system and challenge it from within.
And also from within, many doctors are working behind the scenes to change the situation.
I'd like our doctors to be doctors and not have to worry about this morality commissar that we seem to the Republican Party seems
that
to be pushing
on us. That wins
phrase
of the day, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
it's a good term, though.
Well, I mean, it's true. If you think about it, is that if you're sitting there and trying to give the best advice in an area that is an awful lot of science, but there's also an art to it, and you have somebody sitting over your shoulder saying that if you do this, you're going to go to jail. I mean, think about how much more pressure we've just put on that profession.
That you sort of make more careful choices as a physician. You don't do what's best for the in the interest for the patient, but for you protect yourself. I mean, it reminds me of in the past we had pharmacies who told you, oh, well, you have a prescription for a particular medication, but you can't get it here. we can't give it to you. So they made a moral judgment over what medicine, even prescribed medicine, I could access or could not access. I mean, these are the kinds of consequences we should be extremely concerned about.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to thank our wonderful panelists this morning, and I'm just sort of in awe of you all, of being able to come in and talk about these very difficult issues so eloquently and deeply and thoughtfully, and I appreciate it. That goes for Sarah Rogerson as well, who joined us this morning to talk about her personal experience, which was a very important conversation to have. Terry Gibson, Bob Griffin, and Vera Icarius-Kelly, thank you all for being with us. A great pleasure and honor to have you on the program. We'll return right after this.